This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel, and today we're taking a local look at the Me Too and Time's Up movements and trying to figure out what happens next. If you've got something you want to say about the Me Too movement, maybe something you want to tell your child, a friend, your mom, we're collecting listener letters and we'll share those on our website. You can email us at record@kuow.org. And Marcy Silman is here with me. Hi, Marcy.
Hi, Jeannie.
You've been thinking about Me Too as highlighting a symptom, a big symptom, but a symptom of a bigger systemic problem at work, yes?
Right, Jeannie. Me Too has rightfully focused on sexual harassment, but at least when I take a step back and think about it, harassment is part of this bigger problem at work, and it is systemic. Women, in many cases, aren't treated the same as men in their workplaces, and I'm just going to call it by the S word. It is sexism. Here's just one recent example of what it looks like. Earlier this year, a respected BBC editor quit her job to protest gender pay inequities at the network. Instead of raising salaries, four highly paid male journalists at the Beeb took pay cuts in the name of equity. I was hoping that would become a trend, but I can't see that happening. Worldwide, women still make about 70% of men's salaries for the exact same work. We're less likely to be considered for promotion. And professions that become female-dominated often see a decline in compensation.
Actually, I heard recently that as more women become veterinarians as they go into that field, the overall salary for that profession just keeps going down, as an example of that.
Just one example. And there's more. It is less tangible, Jeannie, but it's no less important. Many of us start to internalize messages we get about ourselves at work. We're not tough enough, or we're too pushy. We're too emotional, or we're too cold. The message is there's a way you're supposed to be and act at work if you want to get rewarded, and many of us are just doing it wrong, or we're maybe not good enough to learn how to do it right. So we're penalized, and in many cases, we're mistreated as a result. Our guests this hour are three very successful women who know some aspects of this, or maybe all three firsthand. Mona Lee Locke is a former journalist, former First Lady of Washington State. She's worked in public, private, and government sectors and continues to do that. Thanks for coming in.
That's my pleasure.
Also with us, Valerie Curtis Newton, a professor of acting and directing and now head of the directing program at the University of Washington, a director in her own right, and an administrator at a giant public university. So you've kind of wear all hats as well. Thanks for being here. Certainly not least, but last on this list is Christy Coulter. She's a Seattle writer. She works in the tech industry. She's been at Amazon. So thank you for coming in as well.
Thanks for having me.
Mona, I want to start with you. I remember when you were on King 5 television, but how old were you when you started your journalism career?
Wow, what a question to start with. I was in my 20s. I was in my late 20s.
So what was that experience like for a young, ambitious woman?
Well, I think it was so competitive in the field, and it was very different world, I hope, back then than it is today. Very male-dominated. You had to swear. You had to be tough. You had to act like them to be considered, seriously.
And did they consider you seriously?
Not in my first job, for sure. No, I mean, I was in the Midwest. I went to, and I wrote about this on Facebook and in the Seattle Times op-ed that I wrote, that I went, it was my first job. I was so excited. I just graduated from graduate school in journalism, and I got there. And, the first thing that happened was they told me I had to go get an exam, physical exam, to make sure that that I was fit for the job. We had to carry 30 pounds of equipment. And so I went to this doctor they assigned me to, and we were going through the exam for the fitness, and he said, "Can I do a breast exam on you?" And I thought, well, is this part of the physical? And he says, "Well, no, but since you're undressed, it would be very easy to just do that." And I said, "No." And then later in the physical at the end, he says, "Well, I need you to do, you know, X amount of sit-ups and push-ups." And I said, "Well, can I get dressed first?" And he said, Oh, sure, you can get dressed. And it turned out subsequently that the employee after me that was hired actually filed a claim, because I was the one called in the office to talk about it, and it was mistaken identity. But so that happened. And then as I worked at this television station, it was during Anita Hill, right? And so there's trial, and so it was very prominent, the sexual harassment issue. And yet then I found out that all the guys apparently at the station had made a bet when I came as to who would sleep with me first. And so that was told to me. And then my news director, I could go on and on.
I know.
The list,
I mean, we could. In fact, there are so many stories like this. So we could spend the whole hour, but we aren't going to do that because there are three of you. And we could spend an hour on all of that. Valerie, when I think about the theater world or the world of entertainment, there's that legendary casting couch. You started off as an actor and then switched to directing. And I imagine that switch had its own difficulties for a woman in theater.
Yeah, I think being a director, I constantly get challenged by male artists in the process. We can be in rehearsal and have people talk over us, even though we're supposed to be the leader of the endeavor. Learning how to handle that, especially as a Black woman, because my response would be to slap them all down, and then I become the angry Black woman. So waltzing between stereotypes has been very difficult to navigate. I will say it's also something about being in the arts, the idea that we are somehow more sexually liberated and bohemian, and that we are unencumbered by the same sorts of mores and traumas that other people are. I remember being an undergraduate and having an acting teacher who wanted to have us be more in touch with our bodies. And so he had these mattresses laid out, and he would say that we needed to pretend that we were making love on these mattresses while he walked amongst us and tried to encourage us to be more and more uninhibited. I have heard other acting students being felt up, being encouraged to take more and more risks, and the idea that, are you brave enough to take your top off, or is the project important enough for you to allow someone to touch you inappropriately? So there's a way in which the idea of what is artistic makes it rife for opportunities for abuses.
So we're going to go from the world of art to the world of tech. And Christy Coulter, there's this, I'm not sure if it is a stereotype, but tech bro. We all hear that term. So you heard Mona Locke, you heard Valerie Curtis Newton. Does any of this sound familiar to you?
Yes. I mean, not the specifics in my career. I've been fortunate enough that it's been many years since I've had to deal with harassment. But, you know, most stereotypes start from a place of truth. So there certainly is such a thing as a tech bro. I've spent most of my career working in environments around tech where women were distinctly in the minority. And what I've experienced is there's a lot of pressure, very subtle pressure, to act like the men around you, whether that's authentic to you or not, to sort of be really tough, not to be emotional, basically to act in ways that people aren't really comfortable with women acting. So on the one hand, if you act like yourself, you're too feminine. But if you act like a man, that makes them nervous. So you kind of can't win. It's like there's an invisible tightrope that you're always trying to walk.
And that echoes what both Valerie and Mona had to say. Now, Mona, I'm curious how, for you, starting in a job, having to walk the gauntlet of people being very abusive sexually and then wanting you to be swear and be tough like a sailor, be like a man. I mean, how does that impact the job that you were actually hired to do?
You know, out in the field, it was okay, except for the people that I dealt with and interviewed. I believe really it came from me to try and be like one of the guys to fit in. I mean, it was really trying to snap them out of thinking me as a woman and in a sexualized way and more so as a colleague and someone who had credibility. So I had to adapt to be like them.
And Valerie, you mentioned that you didn't, you know, your natural inclination was to slap people down, but you didn't want to be the tough Black woman. There's another word that we might use for that as well. We're euphemizing here. How did this impact the job that you had to do being the artistic person in charge of a production?
Every bad piece of theater I ever have made has been trying to accommodate someone else's idea of who I am. That when I'm true to myself, I'm relatively successful. Not all the time, but most of the time. And when I'm busy being preoccupied with how other people see me, I invariably fail.
Is that something you had to learn how to do, or is that inherent to you?
I had to learn it by making bad theater and being ashamed of the work I put out and sort of eventually vowing not to do that. Whether it's good or it's bad, I have to own it. And in order to own it, I have to be present for its making.
Now, we've touched on race, but clearly for Mona and Valerie, the race is as well as gender is a factor. And so how do you think that those dual minefields compounded what you were experiencing in your workplaces, if at all?
I think for me, at least, the first step to moving past it was to actually recognize my own internalized racism. What are the myths and stereotypes about Black people that I believed? So being afraid of being labeled the angry Black woman was something that I also believed. I had to decide that there was no such thing as an angry Black woman, that there are Black women who encountered situations in which anger was a valid and useful response, and that it was a choice. And then I could begin to see other people's racism in action and get that, oh, they're putting that on me because they're actually afraid of my power, afraid of my intellect, afraid of my talent. And it's not my job to make them feel comfortable. It's my job to do my job as effectively and efficiently as I can. But that was a huge shift, was to say, what is it about the stereotype that I believe or that I'm complicit in? Mm. And then how can I break that? And when I break it, then it breaks it for everyone around me.
Now, Mona, I know your situation in the world of journalism became untenable at some point. So you didn't come to that same sort of, maybe you did come to that.
It has been a long process, and I think I am still learning and embracing my boundaries and who I am, right, and what I believe in. Having been in the public eye, feeling like you're in a goldfish bowl, right, really feeling being judged so many ways, I think I've very much held it all inside and in a way have stunted my own growth as a person, as a professional, as a woman. And I think when I went to my first job, because the harassment actually has happened all throughout the years. It's not just at the first job, but I was also the first person of color ever hired for on-air in that market, and they hired a Black photographer the week after me, and the news director got a death threat. Mm. So that was how extreme it was for me. I was accosted in my apartment building. You don't belong here. Go back to your country where you belong. And so, you know, I think it all folds together into identity. And for me, being raised as, you know, second-generation Chinese American, I did defer to others. I was more less assertive, I think, not in the profession, but in general, right? Less assertive as I should have or would have been or as I am today.
And so a lot of that for me as a Caucasian woman, that being less assertive and deferring is very familiar. And Christy Coulter is sitting nodding her head. So there's the just single mantle of assimilating, I think, the messages. I mean, how does that play out for you in the world of tech? You talked about sort of being a guy, but what else did you take away?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, when I was very young, you would get these messages like, oh, if a boy pulls your hair, that just means he likes you. If a boy hits you, it means he likes you. And boy, you really internalize that. And so I internalized this idea. I just always had to get tougher, 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 no matter what, how people treated me or how I was overlooked. But, you know, what doesn't kill you doesn't always make you stronger. It just kind of makes you, like, wounded in a lot of different places. I think for me, the change came. I was listening to what these two women said, and I realized at some point there was no way to be the right amount of female in my career, or the right way to be a woman in the world. So I might as well just do whatever I want. And it was a really powerful moment. And it kind of shifted things for me in a subtle way where I just thought, well, if you can't win, then you might as well just live the life that you want to live. And it's actually made me more authentic. And I think that being kind of beaten into that place of becoming more authentic as a last resort has done great things for me.
So it's really interesting to think about that now. I think I might be the oldest one sitting at this table, but Valerie talked about the process of recognizing what you had internalized and then moving beyond that. I think for those of us I've spent 30 plus years in my profession as well and learned a lot along the way. Valerie, you work with 20-somethings, maybe even younger. And Mona's a mom. And Christy, I'm sure people come to you for advice. So what do you tell them? What do you tell them to think about going into the world of the workplace now?
I tell them to be mindful of their boundaries, to articulate their boundaries clearly and without apology. And that's what I tell the women. And I tell the men to be able to hear when boundaries are being articulated, to listen for it, to be respectful, to be. And I tell all of them to approach each other with compassion and with kindness.
And can they take that in at a young age?
I think they try. And that's what makes me hopeful.
I know, Christy, you have written an essay about your experience that went viral. And in that essay, which is about a lot of things, but you talk about being on a panel and addressing an intern. And I mean, you're trying your best to be honest in a situation where people gainsay you or mansplain you.
Yes. I don't think I even knew the word mansplain at the time, but I was basically I was asked what it was like to be a woman at my company, and I was the only woman on the panel, so I answered the question. And then all three men on the panel basically said, no, I think it's actually a really good place to be a woman. And I just sort of sat there with my mouth hanging open, like, what's happening? How do they know? How would they know? It was very, very strange.
So if you had that panel to redo in 2018 in the wake of Me Too, how would you have handled that?
I would like to think at this point I would be able to, without derailing the entire panel, kind of say, hey, let's take a minute and look at what's happening here. I just said what it was like to be me, and then three men told me that I don't know. How would anyone know but me what it's like to be me? And I'd like to think that the men on the panel and in the audience would be more receptive to listening. I'd love to think I'd have the presence of mind to do that.
Without having your jaw drop. Mona, what about you're a mom and a worker? So what do you tell your kids?
You know, I think they've grown up and they've actually seen me go through some of these incidences where an attorney told me, don't talk to HR because you're going to be the one that suffers in the long run. So my son had said, you know, Mom, I know you're going to have a voice someday for other women. And that's kind of what sparked me posting the post I did on sexual harassment a year ago. I think, honestly, it's a cultural change that will take time and I think patience and communication between both genders. I think we're at a place now where the men are just so freaked out. They're like, well, I won't go to lunch with a woman. I won't do this, right, or that. And I'm thinking it's more conversation. It's more for the men to be at the table partnering with the women or change won't happen.
You published your own story just prior to the presidential election in 2016. We are talking just over a year after that. The burst of Me Too and Time's Out have really hit. I mean, it's every day for those of us in the news business, like who's been outed, what's happened. I'm wondering, Mona, how you feel a year later, you were way ahead of the curve, I guess.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
But in speaking out, yes, I think it's been amazing to see all the voices in the Me Too movement and see all the people stepping forward. I think it's a pendulum because I've been asked, does it ever swing too far where anyone that's even accused is thrown out? And I think the pendulum also always has to swing too far one way before it centralizes and moderates in a movement. And I think, again, having all the partners at the table is going to make a difference, right? Like, if someone offends you, they may not have meant to, but really having an open discussion with them and them being able to listen and alter their behavior, that's what's going to take. And I really think it's going to be in the homes. By the time you're in high school, college, it's almost too late when you look at the sexual assault rates of 1 in 4, 1 in 5 women by the time they graduate from college. You really have to start in the home in educating the youth.
We'll be talking about that later this hour as our show continues. Valerie, you have now a position of power where you can influence young people who are going to go out into the workplace. Do you feel optimistic about society changing, about cultural values shifting?
I think I'm a little bit still unsure about the future, in that I think the question of intersectionality is important. I think when and how we reintroduce the concept of due process is also important. Until we solve those things, it's hard to be truly optimistic, because they've been sort of a Gordian knot that we have not been able to untie for all this time.
And unfortunately, we have to leave this portion of our conversation there. That voice was Valerie Curtis-Newtons. She's a professor and head of the directing program at the University of Washington. Mona Locke, former journalist, former first lady of Washington State, who now works in the private sector, but she's seen it all from her vantage points. And Christy Coulter, a Seattle writer who's worked in the tech industry here in Seattle for more than a decade. Her book, Nothing Good Can Come From This, will be in stores this summer. We want to hear from you, listeners. Email us at record@kuow.org. And if you like what you're listening to and want to know in advance when we're working on stories that relate to this topic, join our email list. Sign up, kuow.org/record.
And we've been talking about white-collar workplaces so far, but obviously we know harassment and misogyny aren't limited to the office. And so right after this break, we're going to meet two women, both of whom have worked on Washington farms, and they'll tell us what they've seen, what they've experienced, and what we as a society need to do about it. So we're going to have that conversation next. Thank you all for this conversation. More coming up on The Record. Stay tuned. Thanks for joining us on The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel. Earlier this year, when the Silence Breakers were named Time's People of the Year, among the pop stars and actresses was a woman named Isabel Pasquale. She works picking strawberries, and she asked that a pseudonym be used to protect her identity. One in four farm workers will face sexual harassment on the job, and women like Pasquale and my next guests say we need more than the Me Too or Time's Up hashtag to change that. Rosaline de Guillen is the executive director of Community to Community. That's a woman-led food justice movement here in Washington State. And Cecilia de Leon is a volunteer with Community to Community. Both women are former farm workers. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So, Cecilia, you started working in the berry fields in Whatcom County in your early teens. What was that like for you?
You know, when I was working out in the fields when I was 13, I was still innocent at that age, and I didn't know what wasn't a proper touch.
And you were in your early teens. I mean, did you have any sense of what you should do about that inappropriate touching at the time? Did you have any sense of what you should do, who you should talk to about it?
No, I really didn't know what to do. When it happened, like, my body just kind of went cold. I kind of froze. I just stayed quiet, I guess you could say, for about the first year that it happened.
Rosalinda, how common is that experience that Cecilia just described?
I think we can say it's, as a farm worker in the Northwest, it's very, very common. Almost an everyday occurrence, depending on where the work is being done. There's a lot of reasons for that. It depends on the crop. If it's an isolated area, with berries, it's harder because, you know, the berries are taller. The blueberry and blackberry bushes are pretty high up. So again, there's a lot of, factors involved, I guess, but it's very common, very common.
Have you seen any changes for farm workers over time? Has this issue changed much in the last several decades?
I think this is one of the issues that has remained pretty constant for farm workers and farm worker women and farm worker girls. I have actually, in many ways, have seen it get worse. It's almost like it's part of the culture out in the fields. I shouldn't say that it seems like it's almost part of the culture. I want to say it is part of the culture in the fields. the whole thing about supervisors holding power, you know, all of these issues have not changed. And it all goes back to the fact of how people look at farm workers. We're invisible in a community. So there really have not been very many changes. The stories that I hear from women now, all ages, let me tell you, there was a woman in a clam digging company that was in her late 50s that was constantly sexually harassed by a supervisor. And he was very manipulative about it. She was an older woman. Like she said, I'm really tired. I'm old. Why can't he just leave me alone? What does he want? This is never ending. And I think this is why we're so outspoken about it and why I say, you know, when I hear movements like the Me Too movement and all that, I think it's a good thing that it's happening. But I always, my heart breaks when I see that it doesn't touch us. There's a culture that's evolved around sexual harassment in terms of women. When I was growing up, we tried to never, ever be alone in a work crew or going to the bathroom. I mean, the bathrooms is a, going to a toilet out in the middle of nowhere in a field is a very dangerous situation sometimes. Trying to not be alone, to always be in groups, to carefully interrupt if there was a conversation going on between a man and a woman, especially an older man and a younger woman, to try to intercept that discussion and intervene. You know, there's ways that women have developed in the fields to protect each other. But sometimes it's just, it's constant. It's every day. You're exhausted. You're in the field sometimes 12, 14 hours a day. It's hard to keep up your own production work and take care of other women that are in the group. And it's a constant. And I think that's why we've developed our own, as Cecilia was saying, the way you look at each other, our own body mannerisms and language to try to protect each other.
I'm talking with Rosalinda Guillen. She's the executive director of Community to Community. That's a woman-led organization that fights for farm workers' rights. I'm also talking with Cecilia De Leon. She's a volunteer with Community to Community. And both Rosalinda and Cecilia are former farm workers as well. And Cecilia, I know that you've worked off and on in the fields for years, even after the experience you described as a teenager. When did you first decide that you wanted to start talking openly about what happens to women farm workers, about your own experiences?
There was an incident. I'm not going to get too into it. There was an incident about a year ago. I wasn't on the job. I wasn't working then, but I was sexually assaulted. And at that point, that kind of made me realize I need to speak out. And it needs to be heard, you know, because it just wasn't that time. But I was thinking, me and Rosalinda were having a conversation yesterday, and it kind of got me thinking, you know, I was a young girl once. And to go through what I had to go through wasn't okay. And you know, if I could be that person now to speak out for those young girls that are undocumented, that are out there, that's something I want to do. I want to stop it. I want to break that cycle. I don't want it to happen to nobody else. I have a daughter, and I wouldn't want it to happen to her.
I'm glad you're speaking out about it, Cecilia. And I know that you and Rosalinda have both given this a lot of thought. What do you think needs to happen to break that cycle you're talking about?
Men need to stand up. The men. Yeah, it happens to women, but the men see it. The men need to stand up and say stop. When they see a coworker doing it, be that voice. Because a lot in the cultures, it's, you know, they don't listen to the woman. It's the men. So it's the men. I mean, a man can sit there and watch his friend sit there and touch another woman. So if he's letting that happen, he's also doing the same thing to that woman. So he needs to say, no, stop. This is inappropriate. And he needs to say, you know what? What if that was your wife? What if that was your daughter? They're the ones that have to break that cycle. They have to stand up and take a lead in this.
Rosalinda, what do you think about that? Do you agree with Cecilia that the men need to stand up here?
I do agree. I think that also as mothers, we need to raise our sons to understand what it means, certain behavior means, and especially behavior from girls and women, and for them to be really clear about respecting a woman's personal space in every way, shape, or form. Those are things we can do personally. But what I'm really concerned about is what the agricultural industry should be doing. And the fact that in the way that they structure work, the way that they have treated, you know, farm workers because we are Mexicans, because we're people of color, that we don't deserve the same attention in terms of these rights that are available to us and that they should be respecting. The oversight of their own workforce in the fields and the way they structure the work that they do and how workers are treated. Ultimately, there's a very strong responsibility that I feel that the employer has in ensuring that women and girls are safe in their workplace. And it's like that in every other company and every other job. An employer has the ultimate responsibility to ensure that their workers' workplace is safe in every way, shape, or form, including sexual harassment. So when sexual harassment happens and a woman has nowhere to turn because what she gets is retaliation from the men harassing her or she's fired by the employer, if Hollywood is looking at their structure as an industry and looking for ways to stop this sexual harassment, if the Congress and Washington State Legislature is looking at their structure and finding ways to protect women, the agricultural industry needs to look at their leadership and their structure to protect women in the fields. So I challenge the Washington State Department of Agriculture, the Washington State Department of Labor and Industries, but also all of these big farms to look at their employment structure as an industry. They need to address stopping sexual harassment. And I mean really stopping it. Don't just pay it lip service. It's heartbreaking that we have to keep bringing up these stories over and over and over again, and still nothing changes. I think it's a structural change within the industry that is really important. Don't put the responsibility on the farm worker women to try to protect themselves. Don't put the responsibility on the farm worker families to try to, you know, change the way that women are treated in the fields from the inside out. Almost every fresh vegetable and fruit that every single consumer that's grown in Washington State, that every single consumer eats has been touched by a farm worker, and a lot of it by farm worker women. And are people comfortable knowing that women have been sexually harassed to get you your blueberries and your raspberries and your apples?
Rosalinda, you just said a moment ago, nearly every piece of food that we eat, every piece of produce was at some point touched by a farm worker, likely a woman farm worker. And frankly, that surprised me. We like to tell ourselves in Seattle that we have relationships with the people who provide our food. But if I'm honest, there's a lot I don't know about where my food comes from, even if I do all my shopping at a farmer's market. So what should I be thinking about and looking for when I go to buy food?
Ideally, you should be asking the grocer or whoever it is that brought wherever you're shopping, where that food is coming from. And have they asked the producers about these issues? Of course, you know, we like to think that the ideal product, if an agricultural product, should have the union label on it. Because with a union, we know that women can complain. The complaint will go through a grievance and arbitration process, and she will be listened to and protected. That would be ideal. And the other thing is that if it has a domestic fair trade label, especially from the Agricultural Justice Project, we know that there has been a process that has been followed on the farm where women do have a voice and there is a process for them to complain and be protected. Unfortunately, right now, there is nothing like that. And it's really difficult, I think, for consumers to be able to look at their products and say for sure that product was not produced under with exploitative standards. So I think if you know the farmer, have a conversation with the farmer. If you know the producer, ask them, what measures do you take? I mean, this is a Me Too movement moment, right? So I ask all women out there that have participated in this movement, have you asked your local producers about what steps they are taking now to ensure that their women workers are not being sexually harassed? I think this is something important that women can do in this Me Too moment, is ask farmers and the agricultural industry, what are you doing to ensure, what are you doing different that you haven't done before that will make a difference from women? At least, for God's sake, give us the opportunity to complain without retaliation. Even just that, give us the equal or the even playing field to be able to complain without retaliation.
That was Rosaline de Guillen and Cecilia de Leon. They both work with Community to Community, a women-led organization fighting for farm workers' rights here in Washington State. And later today on All Things Considered, KUOW's Kate Walters will look at sexual harassment at the city of Seattle. A group of employees there is speaking openly about harassment, and we'll find out what the city's planning to do to try and fix those problems. Next up this hour on The Record, how do you talk to your kids about harassment and consent? Bill Radke will guide us through that conversation with two parents who have started those conversations with their own sons. Stick around. Welcome back to The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel, and I'm here with Bill Radke. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Jeannie.
So I'm still thinking about the thing that our last guest, Rosaline de Guillen, said, that we need to raise our sons to respect a woman's personal space. That really stayed with me.
Right. That was a great conversation, by the way. Yes, raising our sons. It's on the boys. Do you hear that? Tween and teenaged boys, you are going to be the next generation of better men. And I'm not kidding around with you, boys. Your moms are here. Okay? That's how serious I am about this. Jody Allard is managing editor at the monthly parenting magazine Parent Map, a mother of two young men and their sisters. Hi, Jody.
Hi.
Good to see you again.
Good to be here.
Seattle writer and Seattle U journalism professor Sonora Jaw, finishing a memoir about raising a feminist son. Welcome, Sonora.
Thank you.
Jody, you wrote in the Washington Post, of all places, quote, "My sons are part of the problem." What did you mean by that?
Yeah, that was during the Brock Turner case, and I started talking to my sons kind of about that case in the news and, you know, just sexual assault in general. And I think as a parent, it's really tempting to feel like, you know, I'm going to raise a good kid, he's going to be a kind kid, and that's it, and my job is done, and he's not going to be one of these awful men that, you know, harasses or abuses. And at a certain point, as my kids became teenage boys, I started to realize, you know, they're teenage boys. Mm-hmm. No matter what foundation that I've given them, you know, they're good kids. And, you know, in a lot of ways, they're far better feminists than any teenage boy that I knew when I was 15 or 16. But there's still a lot of work to be done. And for me, that line is really about, you know, all of our kids, all of our boys are part of the problem. It's not just mine. I could have written that about anybody's kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just recognizing the work to be done.
Okay. Well, I certainly want to hear about your boys' reactions to being mm-hmm. told that they're part of the problem. I want to bring in Sonora Jaw. Sonora, what's your experience? Did you tell your son he's part of the problem?
Oh, yeah. We definitely had some fights where he had to hear that kind of a thing. But also, you know, now he's 22 and I get to sort of look back and see some of the, you know, some of the outcomes of that kind of upbringing where this issue of masculinity was sort of front and center. And part of it was from the life choices that I was making that he was aware of and being sensitive to. And part of it was direct conversations. also in the piece that I wrote recently, I talked about the first time he asked about when boys and girls are ready to have sex, and he was in sixth or seventh grade.
Yes, he was in the back of the car.
Yes, that's the best place to talk to teenagers because they don't have to make eye contact.
Amen.
Yeah, and I said that girls may not be ready, and for him to hear that from his mother and to listen, there's something that goes out into the world, and he's able to speak up, and I often heard him speak to his male friends and sort of say, I don't like to talk about women that way. And that felt really good. So
I like that part of your answer to him was about being a friend.
Yes.
Will you tell us about that?
Yes, because that's really what we're seeing in things like the Aziz Ansari case, that you really have to be present to a woman's discomfort as well as her pleasure, right? So if you are having, you're on a date or you're having sex, that a woman is probably likely because of socialization and because of that particular moment and all the things that she comes in with, she's going to have a lot going on and a lot of pressures on her. And to be her friend and to listen is not going to take away from the pleasure of the moment or the date. It's actually going to enhance it. And you have to trust that a woman who's feeling engaged and happy is going to be much more fun to be with.
And Sonora, from what I've read of your writing, your son has been more open to this conversation with you. But back to Jody. First of all, your sons are how old?
They're 17 and 19 now.
17 and 19 now. Oh, so when they read in the Washington Post that they're part of the problem, especially your oldest son, reacted how?
I mean, they read my work when it has to do with them before, I'll talk to them about it and they're okay with it. You know, and I'd written for other publications before. They didn't really anticipate that this would go to people they might know, because maybe your average 16-year-old boy doesn't read the Washington Post, or at least kind of that's what we thought. But this particular article got a lot of reactions, and so teachers brought it into the class. Friends started sharing it. They heard people talking about it on the bus as they're sitting there. And so this was a very visceral experience for them, and they were not very happy. And actually, one of my sons was really angry. He started, seeking out a lot of, conservative viewpoints on YouTube, and he really just kind of rebelled against the whole thing.
He was being defensive.
Yeah, very, very defensive and very like, hey, I'm a good kid. I understand what consent is. And that's when I had to say, and this is in that piece, okay, but what do you do when you hear a friend tell you that maybe they didn't get consent or maybe they pushed a girl to have sex? And the answer is nothing. And I'm like, well, then you're not actually being the good kid. Good is a verb. Like, you don't get to just pat yourself on the back because you know better. You have to actually do something.
Based on the blowback I read about that you got from your oldest son, is this a cautionary tale? Is there a risk in saying something so attention-getting to our kids that, yeah, you too, you're bathed in sexism, you're part of the problem? Because it sounds like your oldest son became a little men's rights activist.
He dipped his toes in it. Yeah. And actually, the funny thing was, I kind of stepped back and I kept saying the same stuff I always say. And I didn't really engage with him on what he was choosing to seek out. And he pretty quickly was like, wow, this is no, I want nothing to do with this.
Uh-huh.
So he kind of came back on his own. You know, it's been a while now. And I think these are hard conversations. You know, adults get upset when they're confronted with their privilege or when they're confronted with their inaction. So if you're going to talk to a tween or a teen about this, you know, you have to have space for them to be angry. You have to have space for them to be defensive. That doesn't mean the conversation's over. That means you're getting to the good part. You know, change is really uncomfortable. If everybody has a little chat about consent and walks away feeling great about it 100% of the time, I would question that not much growth is actually happening. So, yeah, my sons were really mad. Like, it went on for a while, frankly, mostly just because of the degree of publicity. They didn't necessarily care because they'd been hearing me say this stuff for years. So it wasn't the message so much as the degree of publicity. But, yeah, they don't like being told that they have privilege or that they need to seek out enthusiastic consent. You know, my son was like, teenage boys don't ask girls before sex. And I'm like, well, then you're not actually getting consent.
Mm.
A year later, now I hear them and I know that it was worth those uncomfortable moments because they've evolved so much.
Well, let's talk about the degree of the challenge, Sonora. To what extent do you think your, I'm sure, angelic son and boys and men are fighting a biological drive to dominate or feel powerful? What do you have conversations about that?
Yes and no. I don't want to necessarily go to that whole thing about the biological drive, because I feel like that becomes a part of that rape culture conversation where a lot of men absolve themselves saying, well, you know, we're supposed to spread our seed, or, you know, those kind of things. But I think the central conversation that we have kept alive, and you know, he's been watching me be, you know, I'm a journalist and I'm a woman in the world and I'm achieving things as well as feeling vulnerable, and talking also about why boys cannot be vulnerable, or the masculinity issue that, you know, what are the pressures to be masculine and what are the privileges, as Jodi said. But also I think part of why it's been easier, even though it's difficult, is he's a young man of color, right? So I'm raising a brown-skinned male in America. So he does not enjoy some of the entitlements and privileges that, say, his white friends do. And so that had already placed him in a position of inquiry into that and to understanding where the differences are. And I think that gets him to empathize a little more. And we also approached it through many things. Like one of the things I tell other parents is take your kids to the movies, go with them to the movies, talk about the movies, talk about the representations of the women there. Watch television with them. One thing that,
what if they just want to watch movies and TV without their mom?
Right, they don't want. Well, I used to go to bed at 9:30, and he would stay awake later and watch, you know, shows like what was Rome or whatever. You know, there was lots of shows that I felt like not really parental guidance there, but you know, they do want to do that. But he actually enjoyed over time because we would have conversations, because I was open to talking about everything difficult. And that's the thing, where we don't shut them down and we really listen and maybe challenge them a bit here and there, but that there's an atmosphere of that listening.
Jodi, where are you on weeding out friends? You know, no, you're not hanging around with that guy.
You know, I've never really had to do that with my kids. And I'm not sure that I would, because I think that when you kind of ban a kid from hanging out with someone, that becomes their favorite person in the entire world. But in terms of, you know, I think that the real issue as a parent is that bias for action. Teaching kids that it's not that you have to never speak to someone again, but you need to call them out. You need to say, that's not cool. It doesn't have to be a 20-minute lecture on feminism and male privilege. It needs to be that's not cool. And that's all I'm looking for. And I think that is something that even a teen boy feels like, you know what, maybe I can do that.
I'm talking with Jodi Allard from Parent Map and Seattle U journalism professor Sonora Jha. And we want to hear from you, listeners. So please email us at record@kuow.org or call us 206-221-3663. Again, 206-221-3663. What do you want your friends and relatives to know about the Me Too movement? Can you write that in a letter? And if you're comfortable, can you share it with us? Maybe it's your mom, your child, a friend. We would love to read that letter and publish it on our website. Email us at record@kuow.org. What about getting in? We're talking about making ourselves uncomfortable. Sonora, what about getting in other parents' faces, including your friends who are parents, and saying, this parenting isn't okay?
Yeah. I have actually done that a few times. I've lost some friends along the way.
Really?
Yes. But one
over what? Do you mind telling? Well, holding names and telling stories?
Well, I'll tell you about, you know, the other time when these conversations come up is when there are school shootings. And that's another time to talk about toxic masculinity. And I remember being at this gun control meeting and saying, every time there is something like this, I ask my young son, what would it take for you to be violent like this, you know? And he talks about, you know, well, I have a good support structure, I have friends, but I can see alienation of young boys is a problem in America. And when we talk about those issues, you know, there was one mother that said, oh, that's too much. You know, we can't place this burden on our boys. Our boys are good boys, right? We shouldn't say things like this to them. Those boys are evil who are doing these things. And I feel like this, I mean, again, being a bit from the outside, coming from India and not having these clear notions of good and evil as we have here in America. America.
That's interesting.
You know, and the gray spaces in between, to be able to talk about, you know, our boys are going to make mistakes. They're going to get angry. They're going to, you know, they've got pressures on them. So, and I know that you know, several of the moms disapproved of having that kind of a conversation. And I'm glad that the Me Too movement is at this point where we're beginning to be able to tell young men, sort of like what Jody said, that, you know, you are part of the problem. If you are not looking for solutions and actively standing up for two other young men or for your women friends, then you are part of the problem.
We just have a couple minutes left. So, Jody, let's help us focus our mind here at the end of this discussion. Sonora used the word solutions. What can I take away from this conversation? We've just heard Rosalinda said we need to help our boys be better men. What's something we can do?
I would say talk to them. You know, you can't talk about it too much, but a great way to actually have these conversations is not to talk about your son and his choices or, you know, his dating life, but to actually just talk about the headlines, you know, work through consent in those aspects, you know, especially like a 15, 16, 17 year old boy can make those connections and feels much more free to have these dialogues when it isn't quite so personal. And when you can remove a little of that defensiveness, then there's a lot more growth.
Yeah, I've probably gone straight at it a little more often than necessary. How about you, Sonora? Any solution, a suggestion we can take away?
Yeah, I think also listen to them, which is the other end of it. Just really listen to what their pressures are, what's going on in their world, why they feel certain things. Are they afraid? You know, what do they have to say about men saying, oh, now I can't talk to a woman at work and, you know, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And I'm always, I find it refreshing when I listen to my son really stand up and he, you know, says things like he discovered feminism on his own. I had nothing to do with it. Mm. And that's really nice.
You know, we don't need the credit.
Right. I let him have it, you know, so we got to let them have some things and say, yes, you go for it. I'm rooting for you. You lead the charge now.
Let them have it. Sonora Jha, journalism professor, Seattle University, is writing a memoir about raising a feminist son. Jody Allard is managing editor at the monthly news magazine Parent Map, and she writes in the Washington Post and other places. Mother of a couple young men and their sisters as well. And it's been great to talk to both of you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. You know, if you enjoyed this kind of a special episode of The Record, we really focused on the Me Too movement and these stories and these solutions. And if you want to hear when we're working on related stories, maybe help to be on our email list. You can sign up for our email list at kuow.org/record or send us an email at record@kuow.org, or you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Jeannie Yandel. Today's show was made for you by Ajua Jimabrempong, who led all the planning, Amina Alsadi, Jason Pagano, Liz Jones, Jill Jackson, Marcy Silman, and Bill Radke. Bond Huberman tweeting for us today. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.